A charity's website is a vital tool for helping organisations communicate with their service users, beneficiaries, donors and funders alike. With a good website, charities can build trust, drive awareness and even boost fundraising. But a website can only do all this if it is accessible to all. Web accessibility is a relatively recent priority for organisations in every sector. Only in 2019, Scope warned that 9 in 10 of England's biggest councils were on course to miss the legal deadline to make their websites accessible. In 2021, research found that 97% of the top 1 million homepages had detectable accessibility errors. Fortunately, the tide does seem to be turning, with increasing legislation and awareness around web accessibility practices. In the 2023 Charity Digital Skills Report, 45% of charities said reaching and meeting the needs of more diverse users was a priority, up 10 percentage points from 2022. Around 1.3 billion people around the world experience significant disability, according to the World Health Organization, representing one in six of the world's population, many of whom are our beneficiaries, donors, volunteers, employees, leaders, and supporters. Web accessibility is essential to enable everyone to participate in your mission. But we also know that web accessibility can seem really daunting. In this podcast, sponsored by Public Interest Registry, the non-profit organisation that powers the .org domain name, we're going to share the basics of web accessibility and where charities can get started. My name is Laura, I'm a content writer at Charity Digital, and today I'm joined by our head of content, Johan Mark Jones.
Hello.
And our content assistant, Josie Sparling.
Hello.
So, first things first, why is web accessibility so important for charities?
Yeah, I think it's first good to establish that everyone, there's degrees of web accessibility and everyone needs to make an effort according to what they can achieve. There's no way you can level someone with no resources with big organizations. So it's what is within your power. Mm-hmm. Charity Digital, for example, are on that journey, and we do a lot in terms of our language that we use and the sort of accessibility language on that small scale. And that's why I think this will be quite helpful, because we can give a lot of tips and small scale advice. But in terms of actual web design and stuff and the more complex things, a lot of that is actually left up to content management systems a lot of the time. So we actually don't have a lot of power over that. But the first thing to sort of talk about, I think, is the legal side of it. The legal side's quite interesting, because a lot of organizations are actually accountable to it without really knowing about it. I think a good example is that I've worked in content broadly for about 15 years and no one has ever raised this legislation as a concern. And I've worked for websites of varying degrees of accessibility. So it goes back to the Equality Act, which actually builds on the Disability Discrimination Act of 1995. And that suggests that all organizations should make reasonable adjustments to make services accessible. That was primarily built for the physical world, but it also applies to the virtual. But as you can see, reasonable adjustments is quite vague wording. And anytime you explore legislation and you notice vague wording, it's usually quite purposely vague. It's either that governments don't know exactly what they're looking to achieve, or they're leaving it open to allow less rigorous sort of punishments, I suppose. So that legislation has been updated by EU legislation. So the Directive on Accessibility of Websites and Applications, that moved the UK to create, you know, to be conform with EU law, public sector bodies, websites and mobile applications, number two, Accessibility Regulations 2018, a catchy title. So that built on the Equality Act and so on and so forth. That's a more stringent form of legislation, but again, it's kind of has some room for an interpretation. And it only really applies to public sector websites and apps, which does include charities, if they are mostly funded by public funding, provide services that are essential to the public, and provide services directed at people with disabilities. Again, if you read into that, that's all very vague. Ultimately, what charity doesn't provide services that are essential to the public in some form, or could you not argue they do? So again, vague wording is always something to approach with caution. In the US, Laura recently highlighted that Beyonce has been sued, which she's taking this very seriously as ever, with the Americans with Disabilities Act. And that the ADA basically is a framework not dissimilar from the UK and EU legislations. But the ADA basically stipulates that the organizations need to do the bare minimum to provide accessibility to people on their websites. And interestingly, in the US, lawsuits, one of which included Beyonce, but lawsuits, there was over nearly 2,400 lawsuits in 2022 alone. Wow. And basically the consensus is that there is going to be increasing lawsuits, increasing, basically the legislation is going to become a bit more enforced. And, you know, with case law and common law, you actually see a lot more of some changes in that direction. So the legislation's there. It is quite vague, which allows it to be quite easily avoided. And the final thing to say is on the UK and EU legislation, you have a disproportionate burden. So you could basically, organisations can avoid legal action by claiming a disproportionate burden, which just means that if it feels too difficult, basically, then they can almost plead that they don't need to improve accessibilities. That's basically done on an assessment basis based on size and nature of organisation. It's all quite boring stuff, but ultimately it just sort of shows that you actually do have a legal obligation to be accessible. That legal obligation is quite easily manoeuvred around and not particularly well enforced, but that could be changing in the future.
So a bit of a dry start for the podcast maybe, but yes, Nonetheless really importantly, yeah, it's good to know all the legal stuff, and especially if charities are opening themselves up to lawsuits. But we're also not trying to scare charities with this. It's, as Johan says, there are ways around it, but also it's about getting started, and I think that's what this podcast is primarily about, because as Johan also said, Charity Digital is at the beginning of this journey as well. Yeah, we all want to make our websites more accessible. I feel like charities are getting more confident with their digital skills generally.
Yeah.
So it's really important that the next step is making our websites usable for everyone. Which brings me neatly onto our next question. Josie, what do you think about the ethical implications of, you know, web accessibility?
Well, I would start with saying that people with disabilities have the same tasks and goals as anyone else. Mm-hmm. So they shouldn't be held back by what websites, yeah, can offer them. And one way of viewing this is like an extension of the physical world, so ramps and buildings and things like that. Like, it's just the same. It's just a way to make sure people with disabilities can access things in the same way as people without disabilities. And for charity specifically, this can manifest in every way that your website is for people using your services, people who work for you, people who generally want to know what your services are, like the general public, people who want to volunteer or people who want to donate. Any of these people could have disabilities, so you're holding them and yourself back by not including them and not being more accessible in your website. Also, just to reference the social model of disability, which Scope defines as saying that people are disabled by barriers in society, not by their impairment or difference. So you can see it as actually more of a social inequality, which everyone upholds by not making things more accessible and not being aware and taking action to rectifying the inequality.
I actually have some good stats about this. So people with disabilities are more than 50% more likely to face barriers to accessing digital and online services, and also 3 times more likely to not have the skills to access devices or get online. So it is really important that we start doing this. And as Joseph said, these are our donors, our funders. It's just really important that charities exist for the public benefit, and the public is everyone. So yeah, it's really good to do that. So what do charities need to think about to make their website more accessible?
You can start with the font you use on your website. So some good fonts I read were Arial, Calibri, Helvetica, and it should be at least size 12. Another thing is color contrast. There are free color contrast checkers you can use. And another thing is alt text. So describing what's in the image, and there's a very specific way of doing that. So it's not like overloading with descriptive words, but actually describing what is in the image as succinctly as possible. Also, when you're linking, you can make sure that's very descriptive what the link is going to. So if someone's using a screen reader, they can understand, if they're going to click on that, what it's taking them to, rather than just being vague and people can't understand what that's taking them to. Also captioning video content and providing transcripts for audio and video, clear and concise writing, And yeah, that's, yes. Yeah.
That's a really handy, I hope everyone was writing that down. Not to keep reiterating that Charity Digital are going through this process at the moment, but I handle our partnerships content, and a lot of that is linking to ebooks and saying learn more, and instead of saying click here to learn more, it's just part of web accessibility saying learn more, because links to the links on screen readers won't have the surrounding text on it, so it may look really vague and people won't know what they're clicking on, which is actually really bad for cybersecurity reasons as well, because it could be any link. So yeah, I think that's just a I wouldn't want to delve into that, because that's something that personally I've been having to think about a lot more. Mm. And yeah, there's a lot, there's some really good guidance online about this. So Scope have a really good checklist, but there's also AbilityNet, which is, has lots of really helpful resources on even procurement and how you can get your service providers to make sure they're accessible. They have accessibility guidelines and everything as well, which also brings me quite neatly to, looking at your CMS system. I looked at WordPress and I looked at Wix, and they both have guidelines about where they are accessible and what needs improving and how they're improving it as well. So it's on everyone's agenda at the moment, and I think it's really important that charities push that and look for it when they're looking for new sorry, I do think Johan said it earlier, but CMS content management systems. So it's there for definite. You just need to look for it. And also WordPress has some plugins which can show you what's wrong and what's not. And again, Charity Digital are on this journey. I need to stop using, I'm using the J word more than they use it on Strictly Come Dancing, and that's a lot. But the journey, that we started it by looking, there's a website called accessibilitychecker.org. Let me just double check that. accessibilitychecker.org, where you can put your URL in and it will tell you all the things that are wrong. And you're not, important to remember, you're not alone, because as that 2021 research said, 97% of the top 1 million homepages had errors. But I can tell you what the top 5 most common failures were. Do you think that'll be helpful?
Yeah.
Yes.
Ooh, low contrast was the top, so which is super solvable, which I think is really interesting, that it's one of the most solvable ones. As Josie said, there's loads of really online tools where you can check the contrast, really online tools. Yeah. Super online. You know you're on off track when Johan looks at you askance. But yeah, so you can check. So when I've been creating infographics, I always run them through those checkers, because it tells you whether your color. And when you're creating brand guidelines, for example, we on our brand guidelines, it has our color palette, which has the codes for each color that we use. You can make sure that those are in the right contrast. And there's also missing alt text, which, again, as Josie said, is pretty solvable. There's usually an alt text section on a, especially on a CMS system, they have these now, where you can just add your little description in, which is also, I mean, is we're talking about web accessibility being the right thing to do, and it is the right thing to do, but it also helps your SEO, because you can put your keywords in there and show what your articles are about. So it's a bit of a dual win.
Yeah.
But sorry, I really think I'm on one here, but I think alt text is just really, I mean, Twitter has an ability to put alt text on it now, and people still aren't doing it, so get on it. Also, empty links, which is what we were talking about earlier, and missing form input labels and empty buttons. So these are all just descriptive things that are changeable. These are quick wins, I think, as much as we think. I think when you look at the WCAG, the web content accessibility guidelines, they look so dense, and I think there's a lot of people who have translated it into really easy and accessible ways of, getting checklists. Checklists is what I was thinking about. And I think those top 5 things are a really good place to start.
Yeah.
So from errors, we learn.
I think it's also something you mentioned, which was the benefit you receive from a lot of those, independent of it being the right ethical and legal thing to do. It's also the right commercial decision in a lot of in research has shown that more accessible websites have higher engagement in general. Alt text, as Laura mentioned, improves your search engine optimization. So accessible language is typically good for everyone. It's also good for, you know, so Josie mentioned using plain English. These are typically better to read anyway. Mm-hmm. If you go to some of the most popular websites in the world in terms of actual prose, like the New Yorker, for example, they use very accessible plain English a lot of the time, maybe even dealing with complex, you know, topics. Heading structure is an interesting one, because this is one that is so easy to do, and it's one that we, even before this journey, as Laura keeps calling it, began, we didn't think about it, but we were doing it because it's logical. So you have heading structure, basically should be headings. If you think of heading one as your title, then heading two as your subtitles, and then any subtitles under that as three, and you maybe have heading one and then five heading twos, and you know, so on and so forth. It's a hierarchical structure that you probably use anyway, but if you don't, you probably should be using anyway, because it's a natural way of us to read and decipher through information. It's a way of to easily digest, essentially. And Josie as well mentioned transcripts of videos and audio versions of articles. That helps people with dyslexia, for example. But again, it's popular in a commercial sense, because I spoke to a colleague today who told me that they didn't actually like reading articles. They were speaking about one of my articles, which was but they said that when they read them, they didn't mind them. Not my articles, general articles, but they just prefer to consume information through listening. Mm-hmm. So just on a purely basic commercial sense, giving people options for different ways to digest content is always a positive. So I guess the point I'm making in this long-winded way is that you should just... that all of these are benefits and net benefits anyway. Yeah. And all of the ones that Laura mentioned then, I mean, the contrast one is interesting, because that's always felt like one that's a bit more difficult. But a lot of these other ones, if you're not doing them already, you should be doing them. And they're quite easy to do. So try not to get too, I guess that's the main core message I would try and convey in this, is that these are quite achievable. And we felt quite daunted when we started, and we realized a lot of them were really, really simple wins for us.
Yeah, exactly.
And if not, the government will come after you.
Whoa. But yeah.
They won't. Probably.
But yeah, I think that's a really good point to make, again, that there's a duality to this stuff. Like, again, the right thing to do, we need to do it if you want to reach all your donors. You're basically, it's digital inclusion, isn't it?
And yeah,
that's that's why charities exist. We want people to be included. But it also captures benefit anyone who are in a louder and a quiet environment. Good colour contrast, for example, works better when there's glare. I mean, we've all had to brighten our screens in the sunshine, I'm sure. There's a better user experience with improved layout and design, and as Johan said, the plain English. Better user experience will it vastly improves donor retention and people just fundraising for the first time as well, because they're able to... people are so online now, they know what a good user experience looks like, I think, and it's so they want to find information quickly and clearly. If you do those two things, really good.
Glad you enjoyed that, Laura.
I also think it's important to think about some accessibility features can be added with code. So we've been toying a lot with our house style at the moment, and updating your house style is another really quick win that you can get for accessibility reasons. But we have abbreviations where we started putting dots in between so that screen readers can read them instead of reading it as...
acronyms, right?
Yeah, acronyms.
Yeah. Well, I mean, abbreviations as well, but just clarity always helps. We were talking about this in the office, so we decided as a content team to put in full stops between abbreviations and acronyms, because screen readers would read UCK or US for UK or US, for example. So if you're reading that, it can be a bit discombobulating. A word that is discombobulating. So we decided, right, let's change something. And then instead of putting spaces between, so there were two options that seemed to be dominating discourse. One is putting spaces between the individual letters, or another is putting full stops. But what's interesting to me, and maybe Josie has some information on this, but I don't see it in many places. I don't see either usage in many places. Almost all popular websites that I would read or I consume information from don't seem to have this, and I'm not actually sure why, even though we've read in several places that it's a good thing to do for accessibility. I guess maybe it's something to be said about our experience, which is actually, I guess it's not the most enjoyable thing to read, and it's not natural for us to do that. But I guess that is a broader point of a lot of these things may not feel completely natural at first, but you'll kind of imbibe them later on.
I think what I would say to that is a lot of places don't do a lot of accessibility things. That there's I just noticed yesterday I was looking at graphs on a website for just reading, reading
maths, advanced maths reasons.
And I'd learned from researching for this podcast that you shouldn't just rely on colours when conveying things on a graph, because people can be colourblind. Mm. And you can use like shapes or different dotted lines or different things other than colour. And this like very popular website wasn't using that. And that's just something you, from learning that, you then start to notice it, that yeah. a lot of things like...
It's quite strange, considering the house style thing Laura mentioned, which I'm sure we might mention again, that, I mean, we've included it and we're a team. I mean, we write the house style. I tend to write it. Josie and Laura review it. And it's a three-person team. It was a two-person team when we put it together. And it does kind of make me think we have an accessibility section that it's just us trying to do our best, really. We have an inclusive language section, too, because we think that is important, too. Yeah. And it's interesting that we... in some sense, and not patting ourselves on the back by any means, we have a long way to go in various different areas, but we have made steps that other places are unwilling to make. Yeah. And on the very simple level of something like acronyms. So it does show, it's kind of a little bit pessimistic to see, really, I suppose. But perhaps someone, I generally come across really pessimistic on this, so someone burst some optimism.
I think it just goes to show that how relative, but this is what I said in the intro, that it's relatively recent that we started thinking about this on such a big scale. I mean, to say 9 in 10 of the England's biggest councils were going to miss the deadline in 2019 of the legal deadline of having their websites be accessible is pretty shocking, and it's not that long ago. So yeah, I think that it just shows there is a long way to go for it, this become standardised, and that we still have a lot to think about, because I didn't actually know what Josie was just saying about the graphs, but it makes so much sense.
Yeah.
And yeah, so I think it comes down to thinking about it, and I would say that charity should start by sorting out putting in a list what they can achieve, and then thinking about what they can't, and then who they need to talk to. Isn't it called decision maker mapping or something like that? Decision mapping, where you work out who has the power over that area. So it might be your CMS provider, it might be your head of IT, but start having those conversations and thinking about what you can change and what you need.
Yeah.
Quick wins, we've listed the quick wins, there's a lot of them. And I think just showing that you're starting is a really, the worst thing to do is ignore this, because it's going to become increasingly important. It's already become increasingly important.
Just to add one thing is the scope also said that 60% of local authority websites, homepages still aren't accessible to people with disabilities according to the criteria. That means that they didn't meet the regulation and then didn't get punished in any way, assumedly. And that kind of speaks to earlier the pessimism I showed towards that legislation. I think that speaks for itself. Ultimately, if you ignore the legislation, you don't meet the standards, you don't meet the guidelines, what happened to those local councils? What punishment, if any, did they face? And my presumption is none. Hopefully we see that a sort of regulatory change in the future, and maybe a bit more emphasis on the legal side of things, I think.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's going to become, as I said, much more of a risk for legal reasons, but also reputationally as well.
Yeah.
And if it's gone from, you know, if it's becoming increasingly important, that's only going to keep growing, isn't it?
Yeah.
So we've gone through the quick wins and how to identify them, what charities can do to get started, and it is a process of getting started. What tools can help charities on this journey? What have you guys found really helpful in your research, Josie?
I think one of the best things charities can do is go to the other charities, AbilityNet and Scope. They both offer accessibility audits. Yeah, AbilityNet's audit can test your website, whether it meets web accessibility content guidelines, outline non-conformant areas and identify areas for improvement, and identify who is affected from a physical, neurodiverse, sight or hearing disability perspective. And Scope's accessibility audit can support you through an app-only audit, a PC and Mac only audit, or PC, Mac and mobile devices audit. So both of those give a very thorough idea of how accessible your website is.
Yeah. They also have loads of free webinars and also training, which isn't free, but it's an accessible price. And I think I signed up for one of AbilityNet's sessions. I think they're going to be really, really helpful for organisations.
And then the web accessibility checkers, which are not so much audits. They're a bit, they're probably just less stringent versions essentially, but you can do them. They're free and they're online, like intent-based, A-checker, Cynthia Says, functional accessibility evaluator. We'll put some of these in the resources section, as we will, we should have probably said at the time, several of the places we've mentioned. Another thing, we mentioned Housestyle earlier. A good thing to do with Housestyle was just to check who's doing it well, and people in the charity sector are doing it well. So check their Housestyles and see what they include in terms of accessibility. Mm-hmm. And of course, it's worth mentioning inclusive language too. We have a really good webinar recently that we had on inclusive language by Etty. So check that out. We'll put that in the resources too. So yeah, like learn from your peers, learn from people across the sector and see what they're doing. And, you know, don't benchmark yourself against big organizations and always remember to achieve only what you can. But a lot, again, as Laura mentioned, a lot of the stuff that we've mentioned today has been, we're mentioning it because we're a small charity, a small to medium charity, and we're managing to put a lot of this stuff into action. And we've also been so surprised by how easy it's been in some ways. And we've had our own challenges, but particularly on the stuff we can control as a content team in terms of the language and the way that we adapt Housestyle, that stuff can make serious positive gains. So check the Housestyle is a really, really good place to start.
Hard agree. I think that the Web Content Accessibility Guidelines website, I think the written content looks quite scary. Yeah. So I appreciate that. I do think it's worthwhile checking it out. But I also think their video content is really strong and really good at translating a lot of it into much more digestible content, I would say. So I would check out YouTube for that. And also there's a lot of organizations, charities that Josie mentioned and places that Johan mentioned as well, that are dedicated to making this understandable, and it's a common aim. It benefits us all, doesn't it? So again, the worst thing you can do, I think, is ignore it.
So just to mention as well, the WCAG, that was developed by the World Wide Web Consortium, and it's basically defined by four key principles. The make an acronym of POUR. So the first is perceivable, and that would include alt text, video capturing, color contrast, a lot of the stuff we mentioned today. Operable, that includes descriptive links, which Josie mentioned earlier, and stuff that works for only keyboards. Understandable, that includes a lot of the stuff I mentioned and Josie mentioned and some of the stuff Laura mentioned, which is including clear language and consistent user interface as well, which is obviously really helpful. And robust, that includes assistive tech compatibility, HTML that users can interpret, and so on and so forth. So a lot of that's the more sort of in-depth web design CMS stuff that you should hold your service providers to account for. They're the key things. And as Laura said, it's really dense and it's quite overloading of information, but a lot of people are there to make sense of it for you. Yeah. We have articles that we published that really, Kirsty Marin's one of our freelancers, wrote a really, really a great article that makes sense of it, so we'll put that in the resources as well.
Having it in an acronym is a really interesting way and a great way to remember it all and to make it easier to understand. I think thank you very much for telling us that, Johan. It's been very helpful.
You're so welcome.
As Johan says, we'll put all of this, and there's a lot of resources we're aware that we've mentioned a lot in this podcast, and not all in the right order. So we will put it all in the description below. I would also like to just say accessibility bookmarklets. It's what it's called. It's accessibility-bookmarklets.org. Again, we'll put it in the resources. Are really good for loads of tools and resources that you can find. Yeah. That's how I found all the accessibility checkers that we're using. And it helps you know which ones are trusted sites and stuff like that, and abide by the guidelines. But yeah, I think that's all we have time for. Thank you very much to you both for joining us on this podcast.
Thank you.
I'd also just like to thank Public Interest Registry too for sponsoring this episode. Charities who are interested in how to get the most out of their websites can find out more information on their .org Learning Centre website, which we've linked in the description. So thank you for listening and see you next time.
Thank you, everyone.
Thanks.
Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this Charity Digital podcast. The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed are those of the speakers and do not represent the views, thoughts, and opinions of Charity Digital. The material and information presented here is for general information purposes only. Thanks for listening.